What do you think the earliest humans were like? More importantly, what does that belief tell you about what humans are like now? Studying prehistory isn't just an academic exercise, but has present-day implications for global politics and social policies, according to Stefanos Yerolanos, author of the new book, The Invention of Prehistory: Empire, Violence, and Our Obsession with Human Origins. Stefanos is a professor of history at New York University, and he joins us now to share five of his key insights.
If you're anything like me, you fall into rabbit holes whenever you search online. And the best rabbit holes of all are the ones where we learn truths about our world and about ourselves. Works of science, often with some adventure and some history attached to them. My favorites are rabbit holes about prehistory and about human origins, about Neanderthals and cave paintings and the invention of writing and ancient languages and evolution. My name is Stefanos Yerulanos. I'm a historian of science and of concepts. I direct the Erich Maria Remarque Institute at New York University, and I usually write about the human body and the history of medicine, about what it means to be human, about philosophy and time and power. At some point, about a decade ago, I decided that I wanted to write about human origins, not what actually happened in human prehistory, not what happened, you know, tens of thousands of years ago, not how we became human, but instead how we talk about it. How have scientists and intellectuals and everyday readers studied and understood and discussed the human past? How have we come to imagine it, thanks to all the publications that we read? And of course, what is the politics of these discussions? Do human origins and images of the deep past influence our political life? And if so, how do they? So, over a decade of research in 5 countries and 4 languages, I came to write this book, The Invention of Prehistory: Empire, Violence, and Our Obsession with Human Origins. And here are some of the key takeaways, 5 insights from the book. Insight number one. Prehistory isn't just a story of human evolution. We often talk about human origins as if it's just the story of early humans leaving Africa and populating the world, or about our transformation from the ape to human. But it's so much more. It's a story woven out of a whole bunch of problems that scientists and laypeople have obsessed over. It's about the creation of tools and hence of inventiveness and of human posture even. It's about the origin of language, which means about society and about how we communicate with one another. It's the story of the beginnings of agriculture and of cities and of states, and so also a story of the origins of theft and war, violence. It's a story about our brains and about their transformation. But it's also even a story of gender, of male and female roles as these are imagined and pushed back in time so that we can imagine what it is that our ancestors, all the way back then, would have done in their everyday lives. What's more, it's a story with a huge cast of characters. And I don't just mean the scientists like Charles Darwin or Sigmund Freud or Margaret Conkey or so many others who have contributed to it. It is also a story of Neanderthals and ruins, of ancient Germans and supposed Indo-European conquering horse riders, and of feasts under a totem, and indigenous peoples, and tools, and hominids with strange names like Mousterian Man and Peking Man and Lucy and the Tong Baby. And it's about edible murders and primitive matriarchs and lizard brains and cave paintings and shamans. When we look at the past, we fill it with speculation and with beliefs about it. And as I worked, I got really excited about these figures that, rightly or wrongly, populate our knowledge and take this huge, powerful place in our imagination. Insight number two. When we talk about human origins, most of the time, we're not talking about the back then, but we're talking about the now, the present time. So we like to think, when we go down our online rabbit holes or when we read the big famous books like Yuval Harari's Sapiens or David Graeber and David Wengrow's The Dawn of Everything, that what we're doing is we're getting relatively straightforward popular science, that we're learning about the deep past. Unfortunately, things are much more complicated than that, because for a whole two centuries now, people have talked about human origins at once in scientific language and in everyday language. And throughout this history, all the way to today, these two languages, scientific and everyday, have never been pure. They have never been about the past alone. They're languages full of our ideas about ourselves and about our present time. Because we never avoid comparing ourselves to early hominids. We never can skip today's humanity. We never think of them alone. So a century ago, people, for example, thought of themselves as civilized, and they regularly talked about savages or primitives. And then after World War II, people would talk about how our ancestors were killer apes, which is something that they really did while African peoples were trying to decolonize from European powers. During the computer revolution, scientists would talk about tools and Homo faber and Homo habilis, which were really tool makers. It's as though the more that we got into computers, the more we were compelled to talk about how we were originally tool makers or creators. And today we're constantly trying to find the right language to talk about the past. Some people talk about a creative imagination. Others talk about the origins of human aggression or about neuroplasticity. Both the good and the bad ideas have everything to do with the way that we can handle the past today. And they all have to do with how we imagine ourselves. Meanwhile, new discoveries don't simply come clean. They're piled onto giant bodies of scientific research. And very often, they participate in very elaborate debates. So many images have been published and have come to define the way that we look at the past. And this is actually terribly important for how we interpret every new thing. So the history of prehistory is a way of recognizing both how perhaps we came to be, but also how we've been talking about ourselves all of this time. Insight number three. The history of human origins is intimately tied to politics, and especially to empire and violence. Now, this is something that really surprised me as I was writing the book. We often talk about things having a political meaning or even an unintended political meaning. But in fact, politics is all over the history of human origins. The word primitive is one easy example. Europeans who thought themselves civilized and advanced would describe early humans as primitive. But that was the same term that they used for indigenous peoples that they encountered around the world. And they really meant it, that when they met native peoples somewhere, they understood these people as literally primitive, as people who had lived in the deep past or who still lived in the deep past and who were going extinct, people who were being replaced by modernity, people who were disappearing as the word went. So the politics of colonialism and of native dispossession depended entirely on this kind of language that justified action, that justified the way that people, you know, thought about themselves and thought about their practices and thought about the people that they were colonizing. Of course, the worst of all were the Nazis. Their anti-Semitism relied fundamentally on their ideas about Aryan versus Semitic racial origins. And National Socialist ideologues mined scientific research all the time in order to justify their annihilationist policies. But this book isn't really about Nazis only. Even after World War II, even among people who meant well and who wanted to be good anti-racists, politics was everywhere, and it was often very problematic. Today, for example, politicians who want to sow fear about refugees use a language about hordes of refugees who are supposedly flooding in. This language, as shown in the book, developed through heavily racist colonial-era talk about prehistory. And so, in short, the way that we talk about ourselves and others in politics is mixed up with the way that we imagine the earliest human past. It's not simply how we imagine the origins of nations, It's also about how we imagine these early humans ostensibly descending into the savanna from the trees in order to start the great adventure of humanity. Insight number 4. Today, we define humanity by way of our origins. For the longest time, I wondered just why we need human origins so much. Why really are we so obsessed with Neanderthals, for example, or with cave paintings? Is it just that they're fascinating and they feel obscure and, you know, in the case of the paintings, they are just so beautiful? I think there's another reason, which is that we have great difficulty today coming up with a definition of what it means to be human. We used to use terms like consciousness or soul or body or human nature, but many of these terms were and are full of problems. The more that we try to think about humanity in inclusive terms, the more that we find these ideas like consciousness or mind or human nature to be quite messy. We might struggle to define consciousness, for example, in a way that's not ableist. Or we might recognize that there are other creatures, like the octopus most famously, that have a certain kind of consciousness. So we get rid of those terms, and now we start wondering, what is it really that distinguishes us as humans? My point is that we've come to obsess about human origins because they offer such a rich story of humanity, and because it is actually easier to explain what it means to be human through this rich history, through the elaborate images, paintings, tools, objects that we have from early humanity. I find this really incredibly fascinating. And in many ways, it's a good thing. In many others, it's a very dangerous one. So it is excellent news if we all use this history of humanity from its earliest beginnings in order to create the sense of equality, that we're all human and we're all equal. But we also use it in order to create our relationship with the natural world, our relationship with the environment. We like to imagine, really, that we are just a bit better, just a bit more complex than those creatures that first descended from the trees into the savanna. That obviously has no relation to the way that we are mishandling the environment today, to the way that we're destroying the very same savannas and the rest of the planet. So again, we tell the story of humanity in order to define what humanity is, in order to define who we are. And that has various benefits and various profound problems that come with it. Insight number 5. It's totally okay to still fall down the rabbit hole, but we really do need to do a double take at the end. It's totally fine to learn about humanity on the basis of its origins, provided that we are critical and intelligent in how we go about it. We obviously need to think more clearly about who we are and how we might coexist in equality and justice, how we might avoid all these strange and awful political images. But this doesn't mean that we can't delight in the early human past and in our expanding knowledge about it, nor does it mean that we can't think more intelligently about politics or about ourselves. Rather, it means that we have to start thinking differently about the past, not accepting this knowledge automatically as if it were unpolitical, as if it were simply pure science, or as if it were simply correct. Now, I've mostly talked about horror stories in this recording, but there are far more progressive stories. There are ways in which the past has been used in order to generate new ideas, new possibilities in politics and society. Feminist debates about women's agency in the 1970s, for example, involved a lot of efforts to destroy images like Man the Hunter, in which man, the powerful hunter, went out hunting and woman supposedly, a prehistoric woman supposedly, stayed at home. That is very much in the past now. And they managed, these same feminist thinkers, managed to transform the way in which people imagined the role of women. In fact, they managed to destroy the sense of an expected eternal role of women. Same way today, if we are sort of stuck, obsessed with our origins, we might as well have some fun with them, provided we understand the weird worlds that they can corner us into. By learning the modern history of our earliest past, we can and we must help direct it and ourselves toward a better future.
Thank you, Stefanos. That was Stefanos Yerolanos, author of the new book, The Invention of Prehistory, Empire, Violence, and Our Obsession with Human Origins. I'm Michael Kovnat. Have a great day.